Hello and welcome to Fourth Estate for the week beginning Monday, June the 8th. From the studios of 2SER and across the Community Radio Network, your weekly discussion on journalism and the media. I'm Rafael Garcia, and on this week's show, how newsworthy is the transition of Kardashian star Caitlyn Jenner, and how much trouble can you get into for insisting on referring to her as a man? Also, Fairfax Media advertises for a journalist and salesperson all in one. Mamma Mia looks to Bangladesh for a sub-editor, and how could the BBC accidentally have killed the Queen on Twitter? Joining us in our panel this week, we have freelance journalist Kate Doeck. Hello, Kate.
Good evening.
Ilias Jushin from The Star Observant. Hello, Ilias.
Hello, Raphael.
And Lucy Watson, freelance writer and online editor at Archer Magazine.
Hey, how's it going?
Hi, Lucy. Stay with us for the next half hour, and as always, you can send us your comments or questions via Twitter. Our handle is Fourth Estate AU. That's all letters, no numbers. Fourth Estate AU. Media Watch host Paul Berry is usually the one doing the criticizing. But the tables turned on Paul this time when he tweeted about Caitlyn Jenner, questioning the news value of her recent transition, which we'll get to a little bit later, but most troubling referring to her as a he. What can be the impact of misgendering someone who's transgender? Lucy, we'll start with you on that one.
Obviously it's a huge problem because, you know, misgendering someone can cause huge psychological like problems because you're referring to them as something that they're not and something that they've sort of spent, you know, a huge part of their life trying to grapple with and understand and come to terms with being constantly misconceived as something that they aren't. So it's just, you know, it has huge implications for someone's like psychological well-being, I think.
Ilias?
I just agree with what Lisa said. It does certainly have huge psychological implications, and it sends a wrong message as well to a lot of people who don't understand trans issues and what trans people grapple with when they come to terms with their gender identity. So, and it also just shows a lack of empathy and a lack of respect and sensitivity. How someone identifies such a personal thing to misgender them is just like throwing it back into their face, and I think it's just quite rude, to be basic.
is it necessarily transphobic?
Beg your pardon?
Is it necessarily transphobic to misgender someone?
I personally think it is, but I think it comes out of ignorance rather than bigotry. In my opinion, ignorance and bigotry are slightly different. Anyone can be ignorant. It just takes a matter of time to educate them, to make them aware and understand. Where the bigot is someone who acts on that ignorance and they see themselves as correct and everyone is wrong, basically. So maybe Paul Barry is probably just quite ignorant in that tweet, and he obviously had to deal with the repercussions of that. Whether I think he's transphobic, I'm not sure. I don't know Paul Barry well enough to say that, but just that particular misgendering incident is a transphobic example. But that's just one tweet. What he is in a big, larger context, I don't know.
Kate, your Twitter account describes you as happily transgender. How offensive is it to be misgendered?
It's extremely offensive to be misgendered. I've had it happen to me a number of different times by both people within the media and outside of the media, and it can be devastating to, like, how you view who you are, and also, like, professionally as well, because then you start going, well, okay, is the fact that, like, I'm transgender influencing the way that people, like, look at me within the community or look at me within the workplace, and that can have quite a negative impact on a person's well-being going forward. So misgendering is definitely a big issue. Now, in regards to Paul Barry, however, I have met Paul a number of different times in the past. I wouldn't say that, like, he is a transphobe, but, like, I would say that, like, he does have a history of being ignorant in regards to these issues going forward. And I've had a couple of encounters with him that have been similar in the past, like where he's got in and said to me over the phone, does Twitter know that Kate Doeck is really a man? And that sort of stuff, it can it can hurt, but at the same time, you've also just got to go, well, okay, not everybody knows what it means to be transgender. Not everyone knows about the personal struggles that a lot of trans people go through. I think in many ways we're about we're where the gay community was about 20 years ago in regards to trans issues, I think, at the moment. And as we continue to have people like Caitlyn Jenner and Kate McGregor, for example, coming forward, who I think was recently on the cover of your magazine, Ilias.
Yep, that's right. Yep.
Like, I think that as we have more people like that coming forward and just saying, like, look, this is who I am. It's just one small part of who I am, but it's a key part. I think that a lot of people will just go, oh, this person is just trying to be themselves, and that'll be reflected within the media as well.
Lucy, does Australian media have a long way to go when it comes to reporting on transgender issues?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like what Kate was saying, where, you know, we're sort of at the stage with transgender rights where we were with gay rights sort of 20, 25 years ago, you know. So I think we're at this sort of first step now where the media is recognising that transgender people exist and visibilising them as a result. And, you know, they're becoming sort of a huge news story because it's this, you know, when Time last year had Laverne Cox on the cover and they labelled it the sort of transgender tipping point, you know, it was like as though it was some kind of amazing thing that transgender people suddenly exist. It's like, you know, they've been around forever, but they've been so invisibilised, particularly by the media, but also by society at a larger scale. So we're kind of at that point now where we're starting to see people be visibilised, which is good, but they're still sort of held up and pinpointed for being different and for being something that is not us. So we sort of need to get to that point where we can just have, you know, coverage of transgender stories and issues like it's an everyday thing, which is sort of where we're getting at with sort of gay stories at the moment.
I think it also reflects a bit of like an issue that the media has been having for a while as well, like how to properly get in and address trans people, how to like how to write about us, for example, how to engage with us. And over the past about 9 months, both with the horrific murder that occurred up there in Brisbane last year, and also more recently, like with the whole situation surrounding Caitlyn Jenner, for example, I've just had so many people like from media trying to get in contact with me saying, like, look, where's a good style guide that I can get in and use? What's the correct pronouns to use? And just simple things like that. I think that what we need to do going forward is we need to have someone within the industry get in and produce something that is Australia specific in regards to addressing transgender issues and LGBTI issues as a whole as well, because none of the media outlets here in Australia actually have, even in the workplace side of things, an LGBTI policy at all, or editorial guides for that matter for their staff.
I guess you'd think it's, you know, it can't be that hard, but it sounds like policies are needed or guidelines. BuzzFeed's Rob Stott followed up with the ABC to see if they had any sort of policy along these lines. And basically they said that Paul Berry was entitled to express his views on media issues and that he hadn't breached their social media policy. But the ABC also told BuzzFeed that they didn't have any policy on the use of pronouns. So perhaps we can draft one. Should there be such a policy, and what would it involve?
I think that there definitely needs to be a policy. Like, when you look at the ABC's social media policy as a whole, it is very brief and it is very vague. So they were able to get in and literally say what they said, that, like, look, we didn't have anything that was, like, covered under the policy in regards to this. And, like, yeah, like, they were able to say it with ease because there was nothing there. I think that we've got to, like, go through in regards to not just, like, trans-related issues, but all the sport-related ones too, with what happened with SBS recently. And the media's got to go, like, right, how exactly do we utilise social media? How do we do it in a responsible manner? But also give, like, our staff the leeway in order to be themselves online. And that is a big issue. It's not just the Australian media that's dealing with that. It's the global media as a whole. In regards to transgender-specific things, I actually think that they were wrong in regards to editorial policies, because when you look at section 7.7 of the ABC's editorial policies, it specifically says that you've got to be extremely careful that you don't prejudice against a specific community or specific person. And I think that with the sort of language that Paul Barry used in the tweet which caused the issues to begin with and the follow-on tweets, that that's something that the ABC could have chased up on, because even though it is a personal account that he utilises, it is connected to his Media Watch duties.
Mm. It seems the ABC isn't really the only outlet that needs some sort of guidelines on reporting on transgender issues and, you know, what words can or cannot be used. Koshy on Sunrise seemed fixated on finding out whether Caitlin had the op. Lucy, what gives the media the right to speculate about someone else's genitalia?
I don't have that right. Like, it's just ridiculous. There was that interview last year with Katie Couric and Laverne Cox and Carmen Carrera, and she kept asking them about their operations, and, like, you know, Laverne Cox slammed her down nicely, which is good. Because it is, it's just bizarre that, you know, for some reason the media or people generally sort of tend to think that they can just treat people as though they're not humans, you know, like, by simple etiquette tells me that I can't just go and ask you about your genitals whenever I feel like it. You know, why does it make it any different for a transgender person? And the same thing with, you know, misgendering or misnaming someone. It's like, for Paul Barry as well, for someone who works in the media, who works in fact checking and all that sort of stuff, when someone says, hey, my name's Caitlin, then you call them Caitlin because that's what they've said. That's the truth now. So it's just like, it was just wrong, like, and offensive and just sort of bizarre for them to do that.
Let's get to the point of how newsworthy the news of Caitlyn Jenner having done the transition really is. I guess for many of us, the Kardashian and the Jenner families, they're, you know, they're ones that you could say that we love to hate. We complain endlessly about how the world would be so much better if they were just taken off the screens. Lucy, you're doing a PhD on celebrity news in the queer public sphere. So is Caitlyn Jenner's transition simply more celebrity news, or is it actually a huge media moment for transgender issues?
Well, I think first of all, those two don't necessarily need to be mutually exclusive. I think that celebrity news definitely has its moments. And, you know, while a lot of it is fluff, sometimes, most of the time, often when you look at sort of celebrity news on the whole, it's providing a broader social commentary about the way we should be living our lives and the way that we, you know, behave around other people, the sort of social etiquette that we use, you know, by condemning or condoning certain behaviours in the media that celebrities are doing. That's sort of telling us how we should be living our lives, or starting a debate about what is and what isn't acceptable. And so that's sort of like why celebrity news has relevance in the first place, I think. And now that we've got this huge, huge moment, which is a huge media moment with Caitlyn Jenner, you know, she was all over every news outlet this week, as we all know. It's really important because it's putting transgender issues at the forefront of our society, and it takes a person to do that. When it's a personal issue, we need to hook these news issues onto people. And so it takes a person to do that, and who better than a ridiculously, stupidly famous celebrity to sort of start that conversation and provide the debate.
Mm. Ilios, did Caitlyn Jenner receive more coverage than it deserved?
What was the question, sorry?
Did Caitlyn Jenner receive more coverage than it actually deserved?
No, I think it deserved just the amount of coverage it did deserve. I mean, I'm in the same boat as many people. I wish the Kardashians didn't exist. I love to hate them, even though probably the only good quality about them is that they show a more... It's not just the typical blonde-haired, blue-eyed models strutting about West Hollywood. It's actually, you know, brunettes and stuff. That's probably the only good quality about them. Other than that, it doesn't go further than that. And don't get me started on Kanye West. But anyway, back to the topic. But look, Caitlyn Jenner, I think, has definitely got the coverage she deserved. And a part of me wishes it kept on going because, in a sense, Caitlyn Jenner's become separate from the Kardashians now because she's done such a... huge thing. It's such a personal moment in her life and made it so public. And I just personally wonder if Caitlyn Jenner is aware of how much responsibility she possibly inadvertently got herself in, or how much of an impact she's had, not just on, you know, not just in terms of media, but in terms of just the impact on the millions of trans people around the world who are struggling with their gender identity. The visibility of Caitlyn Jenner is just like, I reckon overtakes Laverne Cox being on the front cover, overtakes when Kate McGregor did an interview with Australian Story. I think it's a pretty big moment, and I think definitely set the standard. And the other can definitely only, it's going to be challenges, but it's definitely be only up from here.
Just briefly and finally on this one, Kate, was it a big moment?
Definitely was a big moment. And it goes beyond the celebrity news side of things as well, because Caitlin, like for well over a generation or more, has also been a sporting idol all across the entire world. So, like, yeah, she won a gold medal for the decathlon, like, in 1976 at the Montreal Olympics, and was basically called the world's greatest athlete at that particular point in time. So when you've got a person who, like, has been probably the role model for macho males, like for well over 20, 30 odd years, coming out as being transgender, like, it is a huge moment. But it's more than that too, because you've also got the fact that, like, people are getting in having discussions left, right and centre in regards to trans people and trans issues in general. Like, even my parents, who have been they've had a rough time with my transition, for example. They looked at what happened with Caitlyn Jenner on the news, and they basically just went, oh, I can start to realise what you've been going through, like, with that, or at least, like, relate to it to an extent. And, like, discussions like that are happening worldwide at the moment. So no matter which way you look at it, whether it's celebrity news, sporting news, or just somebody having the courage to get in and be themselves, it is fantastic news, I think.
I really hope that's what's happening in many other families out there. You're on Fourth Estate. I'm Rafael Garcia, speaking with Ilias Jashin, Kate Doak and Lucy Watson. Fairfax Media this week advertised for a combined position for a sales representative and journalist to join their team in Wagga Wagga. You heard it right. One lucky candidate would get to write the news and sell the advertisements. And we don't need to tell you what the problem is with that. Fairfax have since pulled the ad and said that it was a mistake, that they were looking for a part-time reporter and a part-time salesperson, but not a full-time staffer to do both. But if it was a mistake, it was a pretty elaborate one, seeking someone who could meet news deadlines as well as achieve sales targets, reporting ethically while maximizing advertising sales opportunities. Ilias, an ad like this strikes at the heart of what we would call the church and state separation. Why is this so important, that we keep separating the two, journalism and sales?
Simply because it's just the ethics of journalism become murky. If we end up making a journalist start selling ads, it's already pushing the boundaries enough when journalists are required to start writing advertorials or native advertising, start of source of editorial content. But having them to go out and sell ads at the same time writing news stories just doesn't, I don't know, to me, it does my head in. I don't know how that's even possible. Being a journalist in a regional area is already a multitasking sort of job. It's a sweat job already. I can probably draw similarities to it to when I was working in suburban newspapers. I had multiple rounds, multiple contacts and multiple stories, and I do, like, you know, on average 10 stories for each weekly deadline. And I don't think I would have ever had time to find time to sell ads. So I don't know how it's even physically, legitimately possible to do stories and sell ads at the same time. So that separation just needs to happen, because it would be a massive task.
Lucy, could we ever see that happen?
See, this is kind of interesting for me, because I think certainly when you talk about these kinds of things, all those problems come up with things like news journalism. But I think working in independent media, I've got my PhD supervisor writes about independent magazines as well, and she writes about how these magazines generally have a close relationship with their advertisers, because these are independent magazines that are catering towards a niche audience of a specific interest set, that they can find advertisers that are also part of that specific interest set and catering to that same niche group. And as well as that, all the independent magazines, you know, kind of have a real sort of taste for good aesthetics, and so they'll only sort of print ads that are aesthetically quite beautiful as well. Mm. And so you sort of establish this kind of close relationship as an editor, I suppose, with your advertisers to make sure that their ads are fitting in with your style of the magazine and looking good and providing something more and added value to your magazine. So that's kind of interesting. I mean, obviously that doesn't really impact on the journalism, I don't think, particularly because the journalism in these types of magazines is catering specifically towards that same niche that the advertisers are creating, so that the conflict doesn't sort of tend to arise as much.
Kate, the ad was actually pulled down after Fairfax faced a fair bit of online backlash. Could the ad be testing out the waters on this?
I think it probably is, but if we look at the Australian media as a whole at the moment, both commercial media and also community media as well, this is actually something that's been going on in some way, shape or form for at least 20, 30 odd years. Because with, let's say, like with community radio, for example, all around the country you'll have different presenters, different, like, other media people going and talking with different advertisers all the time in order to get sponsorships. And like, yeah, like, I think that Fairfax has probably just gone, well, how can we maximize like the resources that we've got at hand in terms of like manpower? But I think they're also going, well, we've got to improve our bottom line as well. So I think this is testing the waters. I don't think it's a particularly good idea for larger companies such as Fairfax. Like for a smaller group such as a community radio station, it'd probably be okay. But like for a larger organisation that does investigative journalism at the local level and also at the state and federal and national level, it does present its difficulties going forward. So I think that if they're going to explore this any further, they'd have to find a way that, like, that they can separate the responsibilities of a journalist from their other duties, like, as a salesperson going forward. Like, let's say if they did have a salesperson who was also a journalist, they'd have to make it so that particular journalist was not doing any investigative news coverage. They'd have to be getting in doing something else, like sport, for example, where there isn't as much of a conflict.
Staying on the topic of somewhat surprising job ads, Mamma Mia Women's Network is currently hiring for sub-editor positions, but if you're interested, it seems that you would need some experience and be based in India or Bangladesh. Sub-editing being done overseas is not quite new. Fairfax has been doing it for quite a while. So what's so controversial with this move by Mamma Mia, Elias?
I think the controversy with this, because Mamma Mia always seems to come across controversy, so this is just another one in a long line of controversies it's encountered in the past few years. And I think what adds to it is the mystery surrounding how much these sub-editors would be paid, because it wasn't clearly specified in the job ad, whereas the average sub-editor in Bangladesh would earn just under $5,000 per year. So I guess, you know, it's almost like looking at how, you know, working labor issues or abusive abusive working rights of international workers and taking advantage of them and just not really treating them, giving them what they deserve in terms of payment. Or why can't we pay them equally?
Lucy, Mamma Mia has published articles in the past criticizing how low workers are paid in Bangladesh. Is this just a bit hypocritical that they are now hiring for a position in Bangladesh, paying a wage that would be considerably lower than in Australia?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because, yeah, if they're criticising, you know, all these sort of fashion industries that are underpaying representatives, then, you know, clearly they'd have to make it clear and commit to paying someone a living wage. What's interesting is that obviously the reason they're doing it is to save money, right? Because a living wage in Bangladesh is going to be substantially lower than a living wage in Australia. To pay someone a living wage, a living Australian wage, and have them working in Bangladesh is A, like, completely not the point of what they're trying to do, and B, would just sort of be quite phenomenal to be earning, what, 50-60k in a place where the average was 5. So it's just kind of, it's interesting because I often wonder, you know, if they are getting paid a living wage, that, like, that'll be substantially cheaper than it would be to be in Australia. And you know, you're fostering someone's work and someone's life by providing them with income. Is that a good thing, or is it still problematic because it is just outsourcing to a third world country purely because it is cheaper there? like, I'm not sure.
Moving away from Australia for a moment, and just in the few minutes that we have left, last week a tweet was posted from a BBC producer's account announcing the Queen had died, only to be corrected just a few minutes later. The accidental tweet was posted during a practice run of a royal obituary. Do all news organizations rehearse things like these, Kate?
Many do, especially when you've got a very prominent individual who is getting on, like in into their years, for example. With the Queen, a lot of like media organisations worldwide would have packages ready to go just in case like something did happen overnight, for example, at the drop of a hat. In regards to whether or not you can prevent things like this, though, like accidents always going to happen no matter what. I think, though, that it is a sign that we do need more of a presence of sub-editors, for example, on digital media. And that kind of like brings in the Mamiya example again for a second, because sub-editors basically give you a local feel for story or for the people that you're engaging with. It's not just for the typos that they find, for example, or the grammar issues. It's a feel of the local community or the national community. And I think that this is a sign that the BBC probably does need to tighten up their sub-editorial and wide editorial like policies and all that going forward. But I don't think it's a really hangable offence to have like accidentally put a tweet up like that and then just instantly corrected it. It's something we need to avoid, but it's not a hanging offence.
Elias, just briefly on this one, how damaging can a tweet like this be, really?
I mean, it might be damaging to the brand of BBC as a whole, but to the royal family, I don't think they would care. To the particular journalist, it probably would have been reprimanded behind the scenes. But I mean, like, I'll put my hand up. I've made some accidental tweets before, and I've deleted them, and I've make a correction and just move on. It may have been just a typo. I mean, I really don't know. It's just, I mean, I don't know the full story behind how that tweet came about and why on earth were they doing a practice of it. Why didn't they do it on a separate Twitter account that had no followers? Why do it on that particular account?
Apparently no one really knows. There's an internal investigation taking place. Just briefly, Lucy, can it be avoided, or mistakes will always happen?
Well, yeah, mistakes always tend to happen, particularly with how fast news goes these days. You're just going to make more mistakes because there's less time to fact check. And so you just delete it, storm in a teacup, really. Like, people will forget about it in a month.
That's it from us on Fourth Estate this week. Thank you to our guests, Kate Doak. Thank you, Kate.
Thank you.
Elias Jashan from Star Observer.
Thanks, Raphael.
And Lucy Watson, freelance writer and online editor at Archer Magazine.
Thank you.
My name is Raphael Garcia. We'll be back again at the same time next week.